By training, I'm a political philosopher, and what got me started thinking about peace was, I guess, a comment I read. I think it was in 2003. It was from a speech that President Bush gave, in which he said, and I'm quoting, what people have got to understand is that when we talk about war, we're talking about peace. And the comment stayed with me because in some odd way, it helped me make sense of something which, as a political philosopher, I was familiar with, which was that in the tradition of political, in the modern tradition of political philosophy, as a general matter, the arguments for peace and the arguments for war were roughly symmetrical. That is to say, war and peace were braided together. So people, and the arguments were typically of the following kind, that we go to war to secure the peace. We go to war because if we didn't go to war, there would be more bloodshed. And that's typically how modern wars are justified. Typically, modern wars are justified by saying, if we didn't do this violent thing, then there'd be more violence. There'd be more bloodshed. And so there isn't a kind of strong demarcation between war and peace in the tradition that I'm familiar with. And it was also the case that around about the same time, I noticed that many of my friends, many of whom were on the left, even though they were disturbed by the two wars that America had initiated in Iraq and Afghanistan, it didn't take very much to persuade them, or for them to persuade themselves, that in some sense these wars were necessary. At least the one in Afghanistan was necessary. And I was struck by the fact that most of these people could actually see the rationale for war. And that got me thinking about the question that I've been working on ever since, which is there an interesting distinction between peace and nonviolence? Because, as I've been saying, there didn't seem to be a especially robust distinction between war and peace. You could easily slip from one to the other, and the justifications for war were typically that it promotes the peace. So if the justification for war were that it promotes the peace, well, there can't be too much of a distinction there then. And so I found myself asking the question, well, is there a distinction between peace and nonviolence? And the more I thought about it, the more I was led to think about the writings of Mahatma Gandhi. Because in him there is actually quite a sharp distinction between peace and nonviolence. I don't think it's an overstatement to say, in some sense, that Gandhi was against peace. He was opposed to peace, as a general matter. And he was opposed to peace, I think, because he saw peace as being a kind of punctuation between wars, as distinct from something completely different. And he understood that the one thing that war and peace had in common is that they were both dependent on power, and specifically on political power. That is, you needed power to conduct wars, and you needed power to secure the peace. Nonviolence for Gandhi was something very different. It turns, I think, for him, on a certain denial of power, an attempt to evacuate power. And the idea is not simply that if you didn't have power, you'd have nonviolence. Rather, I think for Gandhi, nonviolence is the thing that becomes evident, or nonviolence is the thing that emerges when one is attentive to everyday life. Without that attention being alloyed to some other goal, some other end. Because it is power, or politics more generally, that is always concerned with some other goal. There's always a larger purpose to politics. It may be justice, it may be equality, it may be supplying healthcare, whatever. Politics always has a goal. For Gandhi, I think nonviolence is the thing that emerges when one is attentive to living without there being another purpose. So nonviolence is, in some sense, a concern with the everyday, a non-instrumental concern with the everyday. So, as a general matter, when Gandhi is asked questions like, what is nonviolence, he gives answers that people find very puzzling. He says things like, nonviolence is being silent. Nonviolence is spinning homespun cotton. Nonviolence is celibacy. Nonviolence is doing something that concentrates your attention on the self. Now, these are very different than what we think of as peace. So, for Gandhi, there is a sense in which peace and nonviolence are at least conceptually, and even in some practical sense, profoundly different. The only way for Gandhi you can have nonviolence is by a certain fortification of the self, by a concentration of the self, by a certain disciplining of the self. While peace is something that happens in collectivities, peace is just, in some sense, the absence of war, a war that can be always resumed. Kant knows this. Kant is very aware of this. Now, there is a kind of, I'll conclude by saying just a little bit about, I think, what I find very interesting about the relationship between Kant's famous essay on perpetual peace and Gandhi. I'll just look at my notes. Oops. One of the senses in which Kant is doing something very different than Gandhi is that he recognizes that he's trying to secure peace. And peace involves, as he says, the will of all together, the collective unity of combined wills. Peace involves this collective unity of combined wills. For Gandhi, peace, non-violence, is something very individual. I don't think Gandhi would have thought really of a non-violent movement in any sense. Or rather, a non-violent movement was just a movement of individuals who were attending to non-violence. There was nothing collective about it. And Gandhi was insistent about this. I mean, Gandhi was insistent that those who joined the Satyagraha movement should decide on their own, privately, individually, did they have the discipline to be nonviolent? The second distinction I think that is worth making, and it's not just between Gandhi and Kant, but I think it's between Gandhi and much of the tradition of modern political philosophy. In that tradition, peace refers to a condition in which life is secured. In which life is safe. For Gandhi, I don't think he's concerned about making life secure. He's not concerned about the security of the body. Gandhi is ultimately concerned about creating a condition of truthfulness. And that truthfulness can easily happen, or that truthfulness can very easily lead to a certain kind of fearlessness about losing the body. So Gandhi is not concerned with security, or what one might call as self-preservation. Indeed, he thinks the first thing a practitioner of non-violence must be prepared for is death, is a kind of sacrifice, not a concern to secure the body, but rather a concern to be prepared to give up the body, to lose the body. But there are other ways in which I think Kant and Gandhi share a certain sensibility. And that's what I want to end on. Kant recognizes that the reason why Kant does not believe in peace treaties is because he thinks of a treaty as something that just brings to an end a war. In that sense, a peace treaty is just a punctuation between wars. And Kant doesn't much care for that. What he wants is to somehow think about the conditions for perpetual peace. Not this peace, not a peace between this country and that country, not a peace in Afghanistan or Iraq, but what might be the conditions for a perpetual peace? And it's in response to that that he proposes the famous League of Peace. Peace that has, it's not a treaty, it's a league of nations who are committed to peace. And Kant recognizes that to have this, you have to celebrate, or you have to, this can't happen simply through the terms of a treaty. Rather, it involves creating grounds for trust. It involves creating the conditions where human beings don't feel dishonored. That's why he places so much emphasis in his idea of perpetual peace on there being republican forms of government. The importance of republican forms of government at one level for Kant is that these are governments that don't dishonor people, that don't evacuate trust. This notion of trust or dignity and dishonoring or dignity, these are the notions with which I think Gandhi could have been a votary of peace. Even though, as I've said, I think ultimately Gandhi is much more concerned with something else, what he calls nonviolence, and less with peace. So let me stop there.
I want to ask you a question to start. You've written so beautifully, and you've spoken eloquently about maybe Gandhi's resistance to thinking of his work as a strategy, right? That you write about how strategy would not necessarily be the right word to use in relationship to Gandhi's thought. And I'm interested in that and talking more about that. I'm also interested in what occupies a great deal of your essay in Raritan, which is this kind of resistance to so easily speaking and invoking the future, so easily kind of drafting a program for the future or invoking the future in the name of a strategy. Could you talk more about that?
Yeah. Well, I think the idea is, look, every war is justified by reference to some future. And there is always a future, at least hypothetically, there is always a future by reference to which any war could be justified. So, you know, one might say, look, you know, if in fact we can get rid of terrorism through these wars that we are conducting, that America is conducting in different parts of the world, well, if we could get rid of terrorism through these wars, we would have achieved something profound and something very important. So there's always a future which helps justify a present war. I think Gandhi, in some sense, doesn't think like that. He doesn't want the justification of war or peace to rest on some account of the future. Instead, he's concerned with the everyday, with the here and the now. So, I mean, let me give you what is no doubt the most controversial example, at least in the West, of Gandhi's advocacy of nonviolence. In the present. In 1937, for obvious reasons, many people wrote to Gandhi asking him if he thought his views on nonviolence could be successful against the Nazis. And he thought deeply about this, and he wrote several articles in one of the journals that he published on this. And this is what he said, roughly. He said, look, if the Jews of Germany, so he starts by saying, he says, look, what's the basis of being a German citizen? His answer, if you're born in Germany, if you earn your livelihood in Germany, if you live there. So the basis of being a German citizen or a French citizen is a very mundane thing. I was born here. I live here. I have a shop here. My family is here. Very mundane things. The basis of citizenship is not that you're Jewish. He says, if you're born, if in this mundane sense you are a German, you're as German as the most purely Aryan. So he starts by saying, Jews in Germany are completely German. Jews in France are as French as the French can be. Now, given what the National Socialists are up to, this, mind you, was a bit before, this was before the death camps were known about, how can the Jews of Germany protect their self-respect? That's the question he wants to answer. He doesn't want to answer the question, how can the Jews of Germany save themselves? It's a different question. The question he's interested in asking is, how can they save their dignity, their self-respect? His answer is, they should simply refuse to abide by the ethnic exclusionary laws, the Nuremberg laws. They should simply refuse that. In refusing that, they should also be prepared to die. So people like Martin Buber and others said, look, this is asking the Jews to commit collective suicide. Gandhi's answer was, but dignity, preserving one's dignity, doesn't assure you that you preserve your life. The point is, Gandhi was not going to say, was not going to engage in a rational calculation about the future. Would this war, in fact, save the Jews in some future? He was perfectly prepared for Jews to be killed in the present. But he was on the grounds that it would preserve their self-respect, their dignity. So here's an example where, unlike everyone who justified the war by reference to some future, Gandhi refused to justify the war and said instead, look, here are the stakes. The stakes are self-respect, not self-preservation. So that's the sense in which I think the logic of nonviolence is not futural, while the logic of peace and the logic of war is almost always futural.
Before, you had spoken of the degree to which clearly you're invested in. Okay. I mean, before you had spoken about the degree to which you're clearly invested in Gandhi's writing and Gandhi's thinking is in his life, but at the same time you said it was a project upstairs, if I heard you correctly. Do you approach Gandhi as kind of offering you a methodology for the present? Do you try to kind of, do I mean, like, what's your relationship to your writing and to your critical evaluation and kind of interrogation of Gandhi's life and thought?
You know, it's a very difficult question, Aaron, because in some sense I feel quite often pessimistic about peace movements and a lot of what goes under the general rubric of peace movements. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm not opposed to them. Okay. But I'm pessimistic because precisely because of this futural logic, they're very easy to co-opt. Mm-hmm. I'm also quite impressed by movements in which there is a kind of non-instrumentalism, mm-hmm. where people are prepared to say, look, what we're demanding is not a new contract. What we're demanding is a certain kind of different way of conceiving of how human beings are treated, mm-hmm. or a different form of, different conception of humanness, a conception of humanness in which the central fact of humanness is not life or self-preservation. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, one does often see people who are prepared to say, look, I mean, I think of somebody like Mandela and many others, you know, lesser known people who are, you know, I guess one of the things I'm impressed by what I see happening in Egypt, in Cairo, is I'm just struck by the number of people who, you know, are taking huge risks, who are not allowing themselves to be, who are not allowing themselves to think in terms of this logic of politics. You know, will a transition be good for Egypt? What might happen to Israel? What might happen to the US? You know, there's something much more elemental here where people are saying, we want our dignity back. Of course, they may be saying other things too. They may be saying, look, the prices are high and we've been screwed and exploited for 30 years and we want bread and, you know, that matters to us. I'm sure they're saying that too. But, you know, after 16, 17 days, to be there in a very disciplined manner, you know, I mean, I can't, honestly, I cannot think of an event where so many people have coalesced and, as a general matter, have been very disciplined. I think the violence that one has seen has been provoked by the government. I just can't recall. You know, when was the last time, you know, large masses of people were this disciplined? I mean, in America, I think the last time was the civil rights struggle, you know, when King was around. I somehow think there's something to that, that is, for me, that addresses the deeper worry I have about the pervasiveness of violence. Because I guess at some level I do think that the pervasiveness of war and violence is something that also often implicates those who are asking for peace.
A colleague of mine, Eduardo Cadava, and I, we've been in an ongoing conversation about kind of this somewhat neglected line of Marx's that whoever drafts programs for the future is a reactionary. And it kind of seems to call into question everything you thought about Marx.
Yeah.
And the conventional ways that Marx is, I think, read. And what we think, what we read Marx as saying is that if you define the future, if you try to just simply draft the future, it's actually not a future at all.
Yeah, so, yeah. I mean, I think there is in Marx this call it romantic side.
Uh-huh.
That is not about the future. You know? That is very much about the everyday, about the present. You know, there is in Marx, I think, a kind of very rich moral vocabulary, as distinct from an economic and political vocabulary, which is what we usually associate with.
Yeah. I have another question, if it's okay, if I ask you questions. At the end of the essay that you had sent me, you have this very interesting discussion, not just of Gandhi, but also of King, of Martin Luther King. And you articulate some of the different ways that they think of nonviolence. And what's so fascinating about, like, the letter from Birmingham Jail, for instance, is that King talks about nonviolence as a creative task, as a task that requires the imagination, which is not a word I tend to think of when I think of Gandhi. So I was interested if you could talk about the role of imagination and in an imaginative sort of way, like what would have happened when King goes to India, Gandhi's already died, correct?
Yeah, he's died.
What would have happened if they had actually sat down and had a conversation with each other? How would have they negotiated these very different ways of thinking about nonviolence that maybe today we would lump together, perhaps too easily or too casually? What might have happened in that conversation, and am I misreading Gandhi when I think that the imagination doesn't play a role or mean something different than the way King invokes it?
Well, I think what King means by the imagination is something strategic. That is, we need to think of new ways,
tactics and strategies,
of imagining tactics.
Yeah. Yeah.
In that sense, I don't think it is the most imaginative use of the imagination.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think it is ultimately a strategic use.
Mm-hmm. An instrumentalized use.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But at root, I think the big difference between Gandhi and King is, and King is very explicit about this, is King sees the civil rights struggle as a fulfillment, as an attempt to fulfill the original political promise of America. It is to make good on that promise for African Americans. So he sees the civil rights struggle as very much a political thing.
And a question of justice.
Yeah, it is getting justice for this group. It is securing their rights. And oddly, I mean, I taught a course on King last year, King and Gandhi, and I was struck by how King, despite being a minister, ultimately his vision for the civil rights struggle is, I think, not inflected by, in a deep way, by his Christianity. It's almost as though the Christianity comes in because you need the churches to organize these people. But it doesn't affect the vision. The vision is ultimately a constitutional vision. It is, this is a land of rights, of individual rights, of equal rights, of justice, of making good on the promise of prosperity. All of these things have been denied to African Americans, and now the time has come for us to make good on that promise. He says explicitly, I don't know if I quoted in that, in the Raritan piece, but I've quoted it elsewhere, where he says, our movement is to fulfill the dream of America, the promise of America. And I think, the more I thought about it, the more I felt that nonviolence was in some sense a strategic thing. King understood that if African Americans in the mid-60s became violent, they would A, lose the crucial support of the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, they would lose the support of Northern liberals, and they would be massacred. They'd just be massacred. So, in this sense, I think nonviolence is a strategy. And by saying that, I don't mean to impugn it. I mean, it's a very good strategy. I'm glad he did that. But it is ultimately a strategy. While for Gandhi, nonviolence is not a strategy, it is a way of, in some sense, consolidating a particular conception, or deepening a conception of the self that he has. A self that ultimately, and that's a religious conception of the self, you know. It's a self that is ultimately to be freed of the prison of the body. So, in some sense, Gandhi's vision is much more kind of entangled with the religious metaphysics of the self than King's is. And so I think, had they met, had they talked about it, Gandhi would have said, all power to you, because there is a lot of injustice there, and I see it, and as strategy, this is a good strategy, but it's not my vision. And that's exactly what King comes to see in 1959 when he comes back from India. He recognizes, there is a kind of tone of amazement and disappointment when he returns from, as he calls it, the land of Gandhi. And I think he realizes this Gandhi was up to something completely different. So I think there is a difference there. And it's... It's a very, I think, good question, Catherine, because at one level, Gandhi is very utopian. At another level, he is thoroughly anti-utopian. He's the most unidealistic of the thinkers I know. Why do I say that? Look, because Gandhi thinks what do you need to be non-violent? Nothing. Nothing. I'll give you an example which will capture I think, or which, at least for me, captures how mundane nonviolence is for him. He's in his ashram, and somebody brings him a pencil with which to write. And he notices that the way the pencil has been sharpened with a knife suggests from the markings on the pencil that the person, or he assumes, the person who was sharpening it was very angry, because he can tell from the way it's been sharpened. So he calls the woman in who'd given him the pencil and said, "Did you sharpen this pencil?" She said, "Yeah." And he says, "Were you angry? Was something wrong? Because I can tell from the way you've sharpened it that it's just full of these harsh marks." And she says, "Yeah, actually something was wrong." And Gandhi says, "Next time, sit down, meditate, do something, dissipate the anger." So here is Gandhi saying, what does it mean to be nonviolent? Sit down, dissipate the anger. Sharpen the pencil in a different way. It's as mundane as you can get. On the other hand, one might say, look, there's something utterly utopian about thinking that people can actually have this completely different investment in the self, where they're not invested in their corporeal selves, but are invested in something else, you know, this returning to God, or, you know, freeing the self of the body. Maybe that's utopian. So it is utopian, and in another sense it's not utopian. It's very mundane. You know, I think for Gandhi, non-violence is involved in what you eat, how you walk, how you live, how you talk to somebody. So in that sense, it's very mundane.
Who was your Raritan text addressed to? Were you writing it for yourself, or were you writing it for a political science community? I ask because, I mean, I'm not in political science, but my sense is that maybe this is not the discourse and the process that you're invested in, interested in thinking through. It's not the one I would tend to associate with your field. Am I wrong?
I think you're right. I mean, you know,
was it addressed to yourself? Was it addressed to maybe?
Wasn't so much addressed to myself. You know, it was just trying to work. I mean, part of it, the first part of that essay, which is very much about the tradition of political theory, you know, it's straight political theory. It shows my training in Western political thought, which is what I'm exclusively trained in. And then being able to see how sharp the contrast is between that tradition of thinking about peace and this other way of conceiving of nonviolence. Now, it just happened to be that I wrote on Gandhi, but there are other thinkers within the Western tradition. Mm-hmm. Simone Weil comes to mind, you know, who it's addressed to, I don't know. I mean, you know, somebody read it, somebody at Yale read it, said, you should send it to Raritan. It's clearly not political science. I don't think I could have published that in any political science journal. But
it's not something that will work. And like you said,
but what do you think work means here? What do you have in? This is exactly what Hannah Arendt said. It's exactly what Hannah Arendt said. Had Gandhi been dealing with the Nazis or the Japanese or Stalin, nonviolence would not have worked. My answer is: What does it mean to work here? I personally think that people like Hannah Arendt believe that really what Gandhi wanted was decolonization. I think that's absolutely wrong. Absolutely wrong. In fact, Gandhi is explicit. He says, the British have as much right to stay in India as I do. The British have been here for 200 years. They are no longer foreigners. He said, I have no objections to the British remaining here. What I have an objection to is their form of power. Arendt is, I think, completely wrong when she thinks that Gandhi is a nationalist. Gandhi was not a nationalist. What would it mean for Gandhi's non-violence not to have worked in Germany? Yeah, Jews would have got killed. For him, that's not working. One other thing I'll just say, that in the Indian context, had Gandhi not been this charismatic figure, we would have never heard of him, because it's not as though Gandhi is by far the minority voice in the Indian struggle for independence. Most people in India were like most nationalists, who were all for violence, or at least constitutionalism. So it's not as though Gandhi is the thing that was natural to Indians. Not at all. Not at all. I mean, Gandhi is a nuisance to the Congress party. He's an absolute nuisance to them. But he had this remarkable capacity to get millions of people drawn to these ideas, and nobody could have predicted that. This question is, I've always asked this question. I mean, Hannah Arendt, of course, asks it of Gandhi, you know, in her book on violence. Could it have worked? And I guess my answer is, look, what does it mean for it to work? Yes, millions of people could have died, and it could have still worked. Gandhi is not saying that he had a way of getting rid of the Nazis, nor is he saying that he had a way of preserving the Jews. He's saying, I have some ideas which might contribute to the self-respect of Jews. Not that he would have saved their lives. And I think the other sense where maybe one can think of Gandhi as it could have worked also is that, partially what Arendt says also, that, you know, something like non-cooperation, at least on Arendt's account, and I think it's a highly controversial account, the Jews collaborated in their own demise by cooperating too much. They were, as you said, very obedient. Now, this reading of the Jews has understandably, you know, come in for a lot of criticism, this Arendt's reading of the Jews, as being the perfect Germans who colluded oddly in their own... What Arendt is saying is, in one sense, very consonant with Gandhi. She's saying, look, they shouldn't have cooperated. They should have been more concerned with as it were their own dignity, their selfhood, in some broader sense. Instead, they were concerned with being good citizens. Being good citizens in a regime that was not concerned with you at all led to a horrible outcome. But in any case, that's a different sort of issue.
Can I ask one final question of you? Very quickly. So to go back to Kant's text, what if one reads it not as a historical text, but as a potential guide that offers us something in the present, some methodology maybe, or even a strategy. Is it, what would you take from the text? Is it Kant's discourse on cosmopolitanism? Is it not that? What do you carry from the text? Kind of, what do you?
I mean, I guess I carry many things. One, it is, I think, the cosmopolitanism. I think what you pointed to, this stuff on hospitality and the stranger, giving hospitality to the stranger. But I also see in this text a certain kind of older nationalism. You know, I mean, he thinks there are nations and they should be organized politically. At some level, I find that troubling. I mean, you know, I think it's very different to say that outsiders should be welcomed and maybe even given permanent status, but always as outsiders. Mm-hmm. As Zimmel says about Jews, he says, Jews were those who always came from elsewhere, but always stayed on. Mm-hmm. But they always were from elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Hmm? So, you know, that's different than saying, look, the nation itself has to be multicultural. Mm-hmm. Kant doesn't believe that. Kant actually believes in a kind of older view of the nation as being roughly anchored in ethnicity. Mm-hmm. There again, I think Gandhi is quite remarkable. Gandhi doesn't have this kind of ethnic component. Mm-hmm. I mean, when Gandhi is asked, what is India? The answers he gives, no self-respecting nationalist would give. You know, he says, there is India in South Africa, there is India in the Middle East. He's not saying there is Indians, huh? He's saying there is India there. And you say, what the hell's wrong with this man? And it's only when you realize he's actually not thinking as a nationalist that stuff makes any sense. But Kant, in that sense, is, yes, he's cosmopolitan, but also wedded to a kind of fairly 19th century, or what comes to be in the 19th century, ethnic nationalism.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alan.
We should stay in touch.
I'd love that.